You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the second hour today, Matt Taibbi is going to be with us. He's got a blockbuster story about looting of our pension funds. But it being our first hour, Senator Bernie Sanders is with us, and with the government shutdown, the recording studio over at the House is not working, so you're here in studio with us. So we actually have a benefit from the government shutdown. Bernie, it's so nice to have you right here in the studio.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. So what's on your mind today? What do you want to cover?
Well, I think the big issue, of course, is the government shutdown. So let me just take a few minutes to outline what's going on. The first point that everybody should understand is that the government could reopen tomorrow if the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, allowed a vote. It's as simple as all that.
He's got a bill on his desk.
Well, he has the Senate bill on his desk, and what we now know is at least 20 Republicans have made public statements that they would vote for what is called a clean continuing resolution, what we passed in the Senate. So it's no longer a debate whether the votes are there. The issue is whether Boehner is prepared to allow all the members of the House of Representatives to vote on the continuing resolution, or whether he's going to remain hostage to 20 or 30 right-wing extremists in the Republican caucus. So that's the issue. That's number one. Number two, it strikes me that in the midst of these very difficult economic times, where real unemployment in this country is close to 14%, we have some 22 million people unemployed today, Tom, where wages have gone down for millions of workers who are working longer hours for lower wages, where the middle class is disappearing, what Congress should be doing now is creating the millions of jobs that our people desperately need, and we can do that by rebuilding the infrastructure, transforming our energy system, many ways that we can create jobs. The one thing that we should not do in this very, very fragile economy is to be telling 800,000 federal workers that they can't come into work, and then telling an additional 1.2 million Americans who are federal employees who are at work today is, thanks for coming in, but we don't know when you're going to get paid and if you're going to get paid. So you got over 2 million workers today. Vast majority of them are middle-class people. Vast majority of them, like every other American, struggles with mortgage and rent payments. They've got to send their kids to child care. They've got to pay their phone bills. They have college debts. They have all the same financial problems that every American has, and they're worried that in 2 weeks they may not get a paycheck. You know, as everybody knows, we had this tragic incident on Capitol Hill yesterday. And actually, I was out on the street there, and I heard the gunshots. And I was there, and as I was walking away from the gunshots, police officers were escorting us back into the Capitol. Capitol police were running to the gunshots. 2 weeks ago, we all know the tragedy that we had in the Navy Yard where 12 people got killed, and the federal law enforcement people were there trading bullets with a killer. That's what these guys do, and we don't know if they're going to get paid. These guys are going to get paid. We don't know if people in the intelligence community are going to get paid. We don't know if FBI agents are going to get paid. We don't know if people dealing with kids in Head Start or the Meals on Wheels program are going to get paid. So this is causing just tremendous anxiety all over this country. And all of the economists tell us that when you have this type of government shutdown and people not getting paychecks and contractors not getting paid, this will have, obviously, a very negative impact on the economy at a time when we want to do the very opposite. We want to grow jobs, expand the economy. This is shrinking the economy, and that is just grotesquely insane. Second of all, we have a situation where, according to the Secretary of Treasury, in a couple of weeks, in mid-October, for the first time in the history of the United States of America, we may be in a position where we're not going to pay our bills, because the Republicans are saying, well, if you don't give us what we want, we are prepared to have the United States of America become a deadbeat nation. We're just not going to pay the bills that we owe. Nobody knows what that will mean for our economy or for the world economy because it's never happened before. It's never happened that the world's largest economy has not paid its bills.
At least it's not happened here. When it's happened in third world countries, they've seen the you know, they have to pay 10, 15, 20% to float debt.
All right. So what everybody does know is that it will be catastrophic. How catastrophic? Will it lead to a world depression? Who knows? Will it simply mean substantial increases in interest rates? Maybe, surely, that. But we don't know. But that these guys are willing to go to the edge on that is beyond belief. Now, what is their whole demand? And here's the issue. I was very reluctant to be supportive of this. But what we passed in the Senate was a continuing resolution, which was a very conservative one. It really acceded to the House on this. It continued sequestration for a couple of more months, which I really hate. I mean, that is underfunding all kinds of programs in this country. But I felt, all right, along with everybody else in the Senate, in the Democratic caucus, that we had to do this. And originally, Boehner had said, if you do that, we'll have an agreement. But he couldn't get that agreement through his right-wing extremists. And what they are demanding is that the only way that they will agree to a continuing resolution is if we defund Obamacare or delay it for a year or do something that will essentially kill that program. Now, the point here that, again, everybody has got to understand, Obamacare was passed almost 4 years ago. I voted for it, but I have said time and time again, this is a modest step forward. I happen to believe in a Medicare for all single-payer system, but what Obamacare will do is expand health insurance to maybe 20 million Americans. And at a time when 48 million Americans have no health insurance, that is not insignificant. It does some other important things. So to my mind, it's not the end of the discussion on health care, but it is a step forward, and it should be supported. What these Republicans are saying is, if you don't kill Obamacare, we're not going to have a budget. We're going to hold the American people hostage. And interestingly enough, I think what many people perceive is, you know what their fear of Obamacare is?
That it'll work.
That it will work. Yeah. And what we are seeing amidst a whole lot of technical problems in the last couple of days is the first day that the exchanges were open, I mean, you had networks breaking down because of the huge deluge of phone calls and web visits that were taking place. So millions of people, to nobody's great surprise, you know, when you got 48 million people who have no health insurance, guess what? They'd like health insurance. And when you got other people who are paying more than they can afford, if they can get more reasonably priced health insurance, guess what? They would like that as well. So what the Republicans are very worried about is that if this program works, people are going to be strongly defending it, as they do defend Social Security and Medicare. The truth is that in this country, the vast majority of the people do believe that the federal government should play a strong role in terms of health care, in terms of education, and in terms of protecting our environment. And Republicans are very, very nervous about seeing Obamacare succeed. So that's kind of where we are right now.
Wouldn't it be safe to say that the net-net is that if Obamacare succeeds, it puts a lie to the Republican meme that government can't do anything right, and therefore maybe we should trust government to, like, regulate banks and the oil industry?
Yeah, it surely does. And I don't want to get into this in a minute, because people should appreciate that this attack on Obamacare is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what these guys believe. And this is the Koch brothers' effort to kind of eviscerate government at every level. So we can talk about that in a moment.
We will. Senator Bernie Sanders is here with us in the studio today. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting. We'll be back with more of your calls for Bernie right after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're back. Oh, we'll be right back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Rick in Lawton, Oklahoma, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, Senator, why do we even have a vote to raise the debt ceiling? This is something we've already spent the money on.
Well, Rick, that's a very good point. I think what some of our right-wing friends are trying to suggest is that by not raising the debt ceiling, somehow we'll be controlling spending. What you said, though, is true. What we are doing by raising the debt ceiling is paying off the debts that the United States government has already incurred. And not to do so would be to default and put the United States in a deadbeat position. But what they are doing by using the debt ceiling, which everybody knows, if it is not raised, could lead to catastrophic economic problems and financial problems all over the world. They are attempting to hold the American people and the Congress hostage and are saying, if you don't give us what we want, in this case, ending Obamacare or slowing it down, we're prepared to drive the entire world economy into very serious distress. And that is that kind of blackmail. And I want to just say this as well, Tom. I know I'm chatting a little bit more than I usually do, but some of this stuff is complicated. What we're dealing with is not just what's happening in 2013, and the president has made this point. This is an issue of precedent. We had an election. And you remember on election night, many of our Republican friends couldn't believe that Obama actually had won. Turned out he won by 5 million votes. They couldn't believe that they lost 2 seats in the Senate. They couldn't believe that they lost some seats in the House. They couldn't believe it. There must be massive voter fraud. The media is lying. It couldn't happen. Well, what this is about is trying, in essence, to annul the election. Okay? So what they are saying, we couldn't get our ideas passed by electing candidates. So what we will do is set the precedent that elections don't really matter. That if we're prepared to shut down the government or not pay the nation's bills, the majority are going to have to collapse and do what we want. If the president and the majority leader and the Senate accede to this blackmail, this will happen next year and the year following and the year following. And it will be a devastating blow to democratic society and free elections, because elections won't matter. It's those people are willing to take hostages who will prevail, and we have to make sure that that does not happen. Not now, not ever.
It's definitely not the idea the founders had. John, in Boca Raton, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders. I often wonder, with such a large divide between the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate and in the House, when you're alone in the lunchroom, you're having lunch, and you have lunch with a Republican senator, do they spout the same things to you, or do they, is it like a wink and a nod, or do they have different ideas, or are they still as strong-willed and like, this is, we're going to shut the government down, or do they tell you things privately that we don't ever hear about?
Well, John, that's a good question, and you know, I think if you ended up talking to many of the Republicans, you would find them to be intelligent guys, nice guys, good family people, etc. So these are not evil people. But I think what's happening, and let me go to the House if I can for a moment, because I used to be in the House and I know a lot of folks in the House, is here is what's going on, Tom. It is not just that you have 20 or 30 Republicans who are right-wing extremists who, you know, are prepared to bring the country down unless they can repeal Obamacare. But here's what else, and this gets to the whole issue of campaign finance reform and Citizens United that you and I have talked about countless times. What is the case, what my understanding is, having talked to people in the House right now, is if you are, say, a moderate Republican, and you're saying, you know, I think this is a screwy idea. I don't like Obamacare, but I don't think we should shut down the government and penalize 2 million American workers. I think I'm going to, you know, go to the speaker and say, you know, let's move this thing along. Let's end the shutdown. The moment you do that, there's going to be some right-wing guy comes to you and says, you know that, Joe, you do that. Let me tell you something. You're going to be primaried. And I can tell you for sure that if it's the Koch brothers or some other right-wing group that has unlimited sums of money, they're going to primary you. And we have all the money in the world. So if you want to oppose us, you're going to lose your seat because we are prepared to spend an endless sum of money to beat you. That is, to answer John's question, that is one of the dynamics that are going on right now. So in the House, and I can tell you, John, and this isn't private conversations of which I've had, these are public discussions. Listen to people like John McCain and others who go to the floor. And what they are saying, in essence, look, We don't like Obamacare. But you can't bring the government down. You can't shut down the government or threaten the financial stability of the entire world economy by not raising the debt ceiling because you disagree. There are ways to deal with that. You know, we have a legislative process. So, John, it is what you're seeing now, front page of the New York Times today. Many of the gray eminences of the Republican Party, maybe the national leaders, past national leaders, are coming forward and say, we are really worried about what these right-wing extremists are doing to the Republican Party. Now, I don't stay up nights worrying about the future of the Republican Party. But that's what they are doing, and they would like a more moderate stance before the American people, because they think their party is going to go down the tubes if we continue moving in this direction.
Yeah. Shane just told me we have just 1 minute until the break, which isn't enough to bring a caller on. How do we solve this? How do we get out of this?
I'll tell you how you solve it. And we're beginning to move in that direction. If the American people make it very, very clear that they believe in democracy, they believe in the legislative process, but they do not believe that a small handful of right-wing extremists should be throwing 800,000 people out of work and cutting back on the services that the American people desperately need. They've got to make that very, very clear. And they are. And the Republicans are beginning to get that message. And that's why you are seeing more and more of the non-right-wing extremists coming forward. We now have 20 people in the House, Republicans in the House, to say we are prepared to pass what is called a clean continuing resolution. We are making progress. We've got to keep that going.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Be sure to check out Bernie's website over at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with more of our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Once again, Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with the second half hour of Brunch with Bernie in just a few minutes. Turn my volume back up here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. First hour of our program on Friday. Senator Bernie Sanders in our studio today, which is the one upside of the government being shut down. He can't come in from the House recording studio, which is far more convenient. And so it's great having you here with
great
us.
Great to be here, Tom.
Gary in Pocatello, Idaho. Gary, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, Tom. And, Senator, it is an honor to speak with you. And I just wanted you to tell the president to stick to his guns and do not bargain with those terrorists on anything, to just tell them to take a hike.
Well, Jerry, where we are right now is, I'm happy to tell you, as a member of the, as an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, that Harry Reid, the majority leader, is standing very, very tall. And he has made it clear to Boehner and to the Republicans that they have got to open the government up. They can do it tomorrow. They can do it today. The votes are there, and they cannot blackmail this government in terms of not paying our debts and driving this country and the world into very, very severe economic problems. I think the president is working hard, and he's doing a good job explaining the issues to the American people. But I have in the past been very concerned that the president has not been strong enough in dealing with the Republicans. But Harry Reid is, and he's tough, and I think the Republicans understand this. Tom and I were just talking during the break here that this issue goes a lot more, a lot further than just the future of Obamacare. It really has everything to do with the kind of government that the American people want. The people who are trying to destroy Obamacare, the people who are trying to hold our government hostage today, let's be very clear. They want to ultimately, sooner than later, destroy Social Security. They do not believe that the government should be involved in retirement programs. They want people to invest in Wall Street. These people made it very clear in the so-called Ryan budget, the Republican budget in the House, They want to voucherize Medicare. That means instead of having the strong Medicare program we have today, they want to give seniors a check, $8,000. You have cancer. Good luck to you. Go out. You got all the hospital care and medical care you need. Here's your $8,000 check. That will last for about 2 days. That's their view on Medicare. In terms of Medicaid, devastating cuts. Some of them want to privatize the Veterans Administration. They want to do away with the Department of Energy while we're trying to deal with global warming. They want to end the Environmental Protection Agency. So what this is about, this is a fight that really speaks a lot more than just Obamacare. It is what kind of society we are going to live in. I believe, quite honestly, that these right-wing extremists represent 15-20% of the American people. And that is why, as Jerry just indicated, we cannot yield on this issue. We cannot yield on this issue, because if we cave now, these guys are going to steamroll all kinds of disastrous processes through the House and hopefully make them law.
John in Chicago, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. My question is about the situation with the post office and their pensions. It seems to me that the original motivation for making the post office fund their pensions 75 years out was to fatten up the calf before slaughter. This, to my understanding, was done by people who want to privatize the post office, and it seems that, you know, this was just a way of fattening up the deal for them once they were able to do that. So I'd like your thoughts on that. Thank you very much.
Okay, what John is talking about is an issue that I have been deeply involved in, and that is the future of the United States Postal Service. What John is referring to is the fact that the Postal Service is the only entity in the United States of America, public or private, that is forced in a 10-year period to fund 75 years of future health retiree benefits. Well, that amounts to about $5.5 billion every single year. So when you pick up the newspaper and the media reports, Postal Service losing billions, what they are saying is that every year the Postal Service has to come up with $5.5 billion. Nobody else in the world, or in the country at least, we believe in the world, has to do something like that. If the Postal Service did not have this onerous burden, they would be, hard to say, either running about even or making a few bucks or losing a few bucks, but certainly they would not be having the financial problems that they are having today, or at least that are attributed to the post office. So what we need to do, and I've introduced legislation to do this that has, I think, over 25 co-sponsors, which protects the Postal Service, does away with this onerous burden, gives them more flexibility to raise revenue and to function in the 21st century. So we're working very hard on that. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of jobs here that some would like to get rid of. And ultimately, I think as John points out, this is just another institution that some of our right-wing Republicans would like to privatize.
Oneida in Montclair, New Jersey. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Oneida?
Oneida?
Oneida, I'm sorry. Yes.
I'm in Sanford, Maine.
Oh, you are? Okay, my apologies.
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay.
Senator Sanders, I don't need to dismiss the importance of the CR, but I was just listening a couple days ago to Annie Goodman on Democracy Now!, and they had a guest speaking about the TPP, and what I heard was so alarming, talking about corporate control of our trade, SOPA, taking away our sovereignty, loss of food safety, and fracking and overriding our laws, worse than the WTO. And it was secret, and Obama is asking for a fast trade, a fast track, and they gave the Congress one chapter out of 25, and they were told you can see it, no notes, and you can't tell anybody what you've seen. And Congress doesn't even know what it is. I'm asking you, what is it? What can you do about it? And how much do you know?
Well, Anita, I know enough to know that this is simply a continuation of extremely bad trade policies. And I know Tom discusses this a whole lot on his show. One of the reasons that we have lost over 50,000 factories in the last 10 years and millions of good-paying jobs has a lot to do with our disastrous trade policies. And that goes back to NAFTA and CAFTA and permanent normal relations with China and other trade agreements, which by and large were written by corporate America with the goal of being able to shut down in this country, move to China and other low-wage countries, hire people there for a fraction of the wages, and then bring your product back into this country tariff-free. The TPP, as best as I can understand, is an extension and an expansion of all of those issues. So I will be a vigorous opponent of that. I think it will, its goal is to continue the war against working people in this country and to benefit multinational corporations.
Laura, in Bristol, Tennessee, you're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for keeping the American people informed. And it's an honor, Bernie Sanders. And I would like to ask if you would ever consider running for president, because you seem to have more of a comment in what, and you're interested in more than, you know, what the American people would like to see happen in the United States. Thank you guys very much. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you very, very much, Laura. To become
I get these once a week, you know. It's a constant.
Well, I very much appreciate it. And, you know, and I will say this, that I think certainly there needs to be in this ongoing debate, there needs to be a progressive voice out there. And I want to see a progressive voice out there. Anita just called up to talk about the TPP. And millions of people share her concerns. And yet what we have seen for so many years, Tom, is this kind of bipartisan Republican, Democratic, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, you know, approach to trade. American people want a different approach. Financial issues, right? Everybody understands that the deregulation of Wall Street has been a disaster for this country, caused the terrible economic problems that we're currently suffering with, and yet you got leaders in both parties who supported that. So there needs to be, and I think there are better people out there than me, but there does need to be a voice out there talking to the needs of working families. You know, what's happened in recent years politically is the Republican Party has moved very far to the right, and we've talked about that a lot. The Democratic Party has also changed. 30, 40 years ago, the Democratic Party was perceived to be a party of the working class of America. Very few people think it is now. I think the Democrats have done a very good job on issues like gay rights, on women's rights. I think they've been strong, reasonably strong on the environment and other issues. They're doing a good job. But on the fundamental issue about standing up for the working class and the middle class of this country and taking on the powerful moneyed interests, I think very few people think the Democrats have been there. And we need voices now to start representing the tens and tens of millions of people who do not believe that they have a voice in Washington or in the White House.
Yeah. And the fact is, not being a Democrat, you couldn't run in the Democratic primary.
No. there needs to be a voice out there, and I suspect there are better voices than me, but I appreciate very much Laura's.
We just have about 5 seconds to the break. Okay. In that case, I will just remind people that we're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program, and we're so grateful that all these years, it's been 8, 9 years, something like that. It's been a long time.
It's been my honor.
Yeah. It is such a pleasure. All these years, Senator Sanders has been with us. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders in just a moment, just after this very short break. It's the Tom Hartman program. You can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. It's running while the government shut down, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It is. Okay, great. You can check it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Once again, that's Sanders.Senate.gov for Bernie's website. We'll be back with more of your questions for United States Senator Bernie Sanders. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Victor in Pittsburgh, Missouri, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, Tom. I'm Senator Sanders. I had contact with my representative and senators, Bond, and I tried to contact
Blunt and McCaskill, your senator.
McCaskill, but she only had a message machine.
Right.
It was full, and I got a hold of Bond though. He was very his people were very receptive to what I had to say, and I said to pass a continuing resolution, and you're creating such strife and such animosity, and you're not going to get anything accomplished. And the thing that my question is this: what bothers me is these Tea Party people, if they're causing, then they're a small percentage, and they're creating this problem. And the way I understand it, the resolution is the proper way of order, the way I understand it.
Yes.
And they are not following the proper way of order.
Yes.
And it's never, this is like revolutionary, like this has never ever been done before. I don't know if this has in the history of any Congress.
I think what we're looking at today is kind of unprecedented.
Okay. Is there a way that you can arrest these people and try them for terrorism and financial terrorism? And to me, they're terrorists and they're treasonous.
Well, no, I don't think you can arrest them. But here's what is very interesting, and I don't want to speak for Roy Blunt, who's one of your senators, but there have been a number of senators, these are conservative senators, who have gone to the floor of the Senate. And what they have said is in a sense, you know, the point that Victor is making is there is a way to do things. There is a legislative process. Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, was passed by the House of Representatives. It was passed by the Senate. It was signed by the President of the United States of America. That is what we call regular order. That is the legislative process in our democratic society. Republicans took it to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court ruled that it is constitutional. Republicans ran for President of the United States, Mitt Romney. Republicans ran for U.S. Senate, House of Representatives, saying, we want to repeal Obamacare. They lost. They lost the election. And now what they're saying is, we don't care about the legislative process. We don't care about the Supreme Court. We don't care about the recent election where Obama won by 5 million votes. We want to repeal it anyhow. And this is extraordinarily undemocratic. And many, and to their credit, many Republicans who I have, you know, politically disagree with very strongly, they are coming to the floor of the Senate and they're saying, yeah, we don't like Obamacare. Yeah, we think it should be defunded. But you know what? You got to pass a continuing resolution. You got to fund the government. We can debate that in the normal course of events. We can bring forth language and legislation, which will not win, by the way, and they know that. But they are in the minority. So Victor's point is a very good point. What these guys are trying to do is incredibly undemocratic. And if they succeed, it sets a horrendous precedent. And Obama made this point, not just for him, but for future presidents.
Warren in New York City. Warren, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to WWRL, by the way.
How do you do? I wanted to ask the senator if he knew why the House has not previously introduced what's called a discharge petition to force a majority vote. But while I was on hold, I noticed that actually this has been done, that there is now a petition that will get the requisite signatures from Republicans to amount to, I think, 218 or
right.
maybe
That's
217
right.
votes
Good.
To force it.
And That's right.
So what I wanted to ask the senator to do is to publicize this so that people understand, you know, as I guess he learned when McCain-Feingold was being passed, that the House rule is not the Hastert rule, it's majority rule.
Right.
And there is a way to do that.
Right. All right, let me explain to everybody what Warren is talking about. When you are the Speaker of the House, as Mr. Boehner is, and you control the Rules Committee, that is enormous power. By and large, you can control what comes up for debate. Unlike the Senate, where the rules are much looser, and people in the minority have much more of an opportunity to get their issues debated on the floor and voted upon. But in the House, it's pretty tight control. Now, what happens when you have a circumstance where a majority of the members of the House want to do something, want to pass a bill, and the majority leader, the guy who controls the process in the House, says, no, I don't want it? Well, there is a recourse, and that is what Warren is talking about. It's called a discharge petition, not used very frequently and hard to bring about, but it exists. And what it says is, if a majority of the members of the House, which is 218 members when they're fully seated, 218 members sign a petition saying, we want this legislation on the floor, it has to get on the floor. So that's a way of going around what the speaker wants. And I think there is discussion about that right now in the House. And I think that is, I think Warren is right. That is a very good direct way to go, because if you have a majority, you want to pass this thing, do a discharge petition, demand that this clean resolution get to the floor. It will then win, and we can end this terrible government shutdown.
Can't discharge petitions, though, only be brought forward on the first and third Monday of the month or something like that? There's like a couple
of
days.
Well, I don't know all of the rules. Yeah. It's been a while since I've been in the House, but there are ways to do it. I mean, Warren's basic point is correct.
That
these guys can do it. And if Republicans have the courage to sign that, along with all of the Democrats, that's one way.
Well, you would think at that point that Congressman Boehner would, just out of respect for his colleagues, not even go through the discharge petition process.
The answer is more complicated than that. I'm afraid that's not the case. I mean, he is more beholden to the Koch brothers and the right-wing extremists at this point than he is to a majority. More afraid of them, yeah.
Yeah, remarkable. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie hour is over. Senator Bernie, thank you so much for being with us. It's been great.
Nice to be in the studio with you.
It really is very nice having you here with us. We'll be back. Matt Taibbi is going to be with us in the next hour. He's got an amazing piece about how the banksters now are trying to loot public employee pensions. And then it's In and Goes Friday. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Anything Goes Friday commences in a few minutes. But first, Matt Taibbi is with us, one of the most brilliant investigative reporters in the United States, in the world, frankly. Contributing editor to the Rolling Stone magazine, rollingstone.com. Matt, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great having you here. So I understand that you and your investigating, perambulating, turning rocks over, especially on Wall Street, have discovered that there is the next takedown that these guys have in their sights is public sector pensions. Do I have this right?
Well, I mean, they've been taking down. That's actually kind of part of the story, is that public sector pensions were a huge target pre-2008 of the whole mortgage-backed security scam, and that's one of the reasons that a lot of them blew up. But now there's a whole bunch of states that are pushing pension reform, and basically the new narrative is that that's not the reason that these funds blew up. The reason they blew up is because worker benefits are too expensive, so therefore we have to cut benefits. And the solution to fixing the problem is pushing the remaining funds into management by hedge funds and private equity funds. So it's kind of like a triple whammy that, you know, basically, you know, first Wall Street blew up the public pension sector, and now as a cure for that problem, they get to have it all under management again. So that's sort of the story.
So let me get this straight. The public, first of all, some people don't know what we're talking about when we say public pensions. We're talking about the retirement funds for state, federal, county, government employees.
Yes, state and municipal.
Yeah, state and municipal. Yeah. Okay, pension funds. Mm-hmm. And the retirement funds for when they... And these funds, these are huge pools of money, billions and billions of dollars, probably an aggregate, over a trillion?
It's like $2.6 trillion in the United States. Yeah, these are basically the biggest piles of institutional money in the country.
Okay, so these funds, they have to figure out a place to put that money on a day-to-day basis, and so they invested, and they invested a fair amount of it back before 2008 in things that these banks were hustling, these collateralized debt obligations and all this nonsense, all these artificial things that came about as a result of Phil Graham's work with Graham Leach Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. In other words, these mortgage-derived products that ultimately blew up and took down the stock market. Do I have that part right?
Right, yeah. They were AAA-rated securities that were not AAA.
Right. So, so the banksters, you know, took all this money from the pension funds and said, oh, just give us the money. We'll give you a great return on it. And they give them $1 trillion, and they say, oh, it blew up. Your $1 trillion is now only $300 billion. Sorry.
Right.
And, okay, and so that's kind of the state of affairs after 2008. And so then the politicians who are the front men for these banksters come along and say, oh, look at the public pension funds are underfunded. And we've been hearing this word. There's not enough money to pay everybody their retirement. That must mean that we're not taking enough money out of people's paychecks. And if we started taking enough money out of people's paychecks, we'd wipe them out. It would be too much. So we have to cut back on their benefits. Am I right so far?
You're right on the money. That's exactly the way it worked.
Okay. Yep. So then these politicians who are the wholly owned shills for the Wall Street banksters say to the people of their state, you know, if we cut back on the benefits a little bit, and also maybe if we take these funds and instead of having the government manage these funds and invest them, even though they're having to buy investments from Wall Street, why don't we just hand them off to the billionaires on Wall Street in the first place and change the nature of the funds even, maybe even change some of them from pensions to 401ks and turn it all over to Lloyd Blankfein and Jamie Dimon and all these guys. And we're going to call this pension reform. Am I right on that too?
You're right on the money. That's exactly the way it works. And a key element here that is really important is that when they're changing the structure of a lot of these funds to these 401k style plans,
right.
They're moving a lot of this money into what they call quote unquote alternative investments. So it's not just, you know, it used to be typically these funds were invested like 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds. That was the old structure. Now what they're trying to do is, and they're saying because of what happened last time, because the stock market blew up, now we need to diversify. And so we need to get a much bigger percentage of other stuff like hedge funds, private equity funds, and venture capital funds.
Which is the stuff that blew up the stock market in the first place, right?
Exactly. And not only that, the hilarious thing, first of all, every hedge fund prospectus, if you've ever seen one, has a gigantic disclaimer on it on the front in huge letters that says, these are high-risk investments, you may lose everything, so be careful.
Right.
Not only are they risky, and not only do they have a bad track record, and not only are they outperformed by random bets on, you know, the Standard & Poor's 500 index,
right.
But they cost about 200 or 300 times what it costs just to bet on an index of stocks.
Amazing.
millions and millions of dollars.
Right. So the banksters are and they're converting people basically from defined benefit plans. You know how much you're going to get for the rest of your life until you die, to defined contribution plans. That is, if you've got $40,000 in your account when you retire, you have $40,000. When it runs out, good luck. The gutter's waiting for you. We're right on that too, right? So
yeah,
I'm curious.
Sorry, just to interrupt. A key thing, a defined contribution plan means the workers aren't getting. You don't know how much you're going to get if you're the worker, but you know how much you're going to be giving. I mean, that part still stays static.
Because what you get is going to depend on how your investment does, and it might blow up.
Exactly.
Amazing. Okay. So what states has this happened successfully in any states so far, and where are they pushing this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's happened all over the country. I mean, it's been happening for the better part of even predating the crisis, this process started.
Is this happening largely in Republican-controlled red states, or is this also happening in democratically controlled blue states?
It's a completely bipartisan phenomenon. You know, the states that I looked at, like in particular Rhode Island, this was implemented by a Democratic Party politician named Gina Raimondo. She's the treasurer there. She's going to be running for governor as well.
And I read in your article that she had a certain conflict of interest.
Well, yeah. I mean, she among other things, she was originally from a venture capital fund that was invested with the state of Rhode Island. But she's amassed a $2 million war chest to run for governor, basically out of thin air, since she started this pension reform fund. A lot of that money has come from out of state. It's come from companies like, you know, from people who work for companies like Bain and Goldman. So that's the other nefarious side of all this is that, you know, the politicians who have their fingers on these purse strings, it's an incredibly easy way to get campaign contributions just by doling out allocations.
Yeah, amazing. So, Matt, we got about 30 seconds here. What can be done about this?
Well, the key thing, I think, is unions have to become aware of all the negative possibilities here, because for years, union reps sat at these pension board meetings, and they would have a consultant come and basically just tell them what to do, and a lot of the times people didn't pay attention because they just trusted what they were being told. And I think the key thing is that if you're a public worker, you got to tell your union leaders to pay attention at these meetings, because you might be giving your money away to somebody who is going to undermine your pension.
So once again, we're back to the position where basically for working people in America, the one line of defense they've got against being screwed is having a union. And that's only, 10% of Americans?
Right, exactly.
Amazing. Exactly. Amazing. Matt Taibbi, you're doing great work, Matt. Keep it up.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone Magazine, rollingstone.com. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday right after the break. Your thoughts, my thoughts, the news. Oh, I'll update you a bit on the news of the day, and then we'll get into a good conversation. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back. Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Why are the Dems fighting, or are they fighting? Is this holding firm really the best form of fighting? Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. It looks like the woman who was driving her car around. This has really been troubling me. And I just... Maybe I'm off base on this. But the woman who was driving that car around, it looks like she was probably experiencing postpartum depression. And if not just that, she had some kind of serious mental illness on top of that, because she was taking antidepressants and she was also had been prescribed anyway. We don't know what she was on at the moment. Antidepressants and anti-schizophrenia drugs. And her family said that since the birth of her child, she was experiencing extreme depression. And there's this thing called postpartum depression. Remember the woman who drove her car with her children in it into the river and drowned her children, and the other woman who killed her kid? I mean, there's Susan Smith, I think, was one of the names. There was somebody else. We've had these cases of these women who have essentially killed themselves and in some cases their children. And this might have been her way of doing it. We don't know. What we do know is that she's not an Al-Qaeda terrorist, and she's not, you know, a Tim McVeigh militia terrorist. She's not a homegrown right-wing American terrorist, and she's not a left-wing, you know, some other country, some other religion terrorist. She wasn't a terrorist at all. And I watched that video where there were five police officers standing around her car after it had already engaged in some pretty wild behavior. And I'm wondering, why are they not shooting out her tires? When they finally stopped her, and there are two stories I've read in the media, and I don't know that we actually have the full story yet, but I've seen one story that she got shot when she was getting out of the car, or had gotten out of the car, and the other that she was shot while she was still in the car. And I can't tell you that I know the truth of either of those, because I've seen two reports in the media of both this morning. Maybe by now, I haven't, you know, I've been on the air for the last hour and a half. I haven't had a chance to check the news. Maybe we know now. But in either case, she was shot so many times in the face that they couldn't identify her by looking at her face. Think about that for a minute. They couldn't identify the body because it was so badly blown up with bullet holes. Why? Why didn't they shoot out the tires? If she was in the car, it seems to me like it's actually more dangerous to kill somebody who is in a moving car, or what has the potential to be a moving car, because when they die, if their foot is on the accelerator, it might fall fully forward and just jam that car forward right into the whole crowd of cops and everything else. And whatever happened to minimum force necessary? Or am I just totally off base on this? Is it just, like, really important if somebody runs to the police that you just shoot them in the head? And I realize it wasn't just running from the police. It was crashing the barricade at the White House and crashing the barricade at the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Capitol building. But is that an executable offense? Is the penalty for running the barriers at the White House and Congress death? What happened to the doctrine? I mean, I got to tell you, you know, maybe I've been thinking about this more than at other times in my life, because last year when Louise and I both had surgery at the same time and we were both laid up in bed for 3 weeks and on a fair number of painkillers, and we would, you know, we'd have these debates about who is sicker, so who gets get to go out and make dinner or, you know, make a coffee in the morning. And just to take our minds off it, we opened a Netflix account, and we watched, like, you know, 5 seasons worth of McMillan and Wife's, because that was a show that we really loved when we were first married, when we were kids. Takes place in the 70s, you know, Rock Hudson and Susan St. James. And he's the chief of police here, the commissioner of police for San Francisco. We watched all of the Columbo episodes that are available on Netflix. We were watching these old cop shows, right, from the 70s. And they didn't come out with SWAT teams. I mean, you had like, you know, the commissioner and his buddy, I forget the guy's name, you know, they'd chase somebody 4 blocks before somebody would pull. In fact, Rock Hudson never carried a gun in that show. If they shot somebody, they'd try to shoot their legs. They always tried to catch them. They try to box their car in with other cars. When did this nation become Dirty Harry? Was it with the Dirty Harry movies in the 80s? Was it Clint Eastwood who changed America? Who made cops feel that, you know, hey, I'm PO'd. I'm going to shoot you in the head. Go ahead, punk. Make my day. I actually think it was. I mean, when I look at the arc of American entertainment, and that's what Louise and I did for a couple of weeks, and I'm a big Clint Eastwood fan, not politically, but I love his movies. And while we were laying in bed, we watched all the old Dirty Harry movies, and we watched, there was another couple that he was involved in, I forget the name of them. And that was during the Reagan era, and as I recall, and it seems like that was the time when the guy who was the rogue cop, who during the McMillan and Wife era, would have been not just fired from the police department, but arrested as a bad cop. With Dirty Harry and Clint Eastwood, early on in the series, it was like, oh, God, do we have to put up with this guy? He's nuts. You know, he keeps killing people. He's like, but he gets results, I guess. And toward the end, it was like everybody's cheering Dirty Harry. It's like everybody wants to be Dirty Harry. And it's now it's like every police officer in America wants to be Dirty Harry. Well, obviously a wild generalization, but our police forces, they're buying tanks, for God's sake. They're using SWAT teams to serve eviction notices and to take out pot dealers. Did they really need to shoot this woman in the head so many times you couldn't identify her?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Or am I just a total bleeding heart liberal? Or both? I'm right and I'm a liberal. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes before the hour. Okay, when I went off on my rant about that woman and did the police need to shoot her, all 12 of our telephone lines were filled, so I don't think anybody has called in about that. Nobody could call in about that, so I'm just going to start picking up phone calls here, and it'll start opening up lines, and if you want to comment on that, you can get in too. Or maybe some of the people on hold will want to change the topic that they're talking about or add their thoughts to it. But Ron in Long Island, listening to WWRL. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
So I guess you got You know why I'm calling?
It says, it says the left is pro-abortion. If the woman who got shot yesterday had an abortion, would she still be alive? Well, that's interesting.
Yes. She probably would, right?
If I don't understand the logic. Present this to me again.
Well, I mean, if she got an abortion, she would still be alive.
Oh, in other words, because she got her pregnancy went to term,
right?
And she gave birth, she got postpartum depression. The postpartum depression made her crazy. Her crazy behavior got her killed. If she had had an abortion rather than having a baby, she would not have had postpartum depression. Is that your point?
Correct.
Okay. Well, presumably that's the case, although she was also on medication for schizophrenia. Debbie Stabenow now has proposed legislation for, you know, more aggressive mental health treatment in the United States. We do a very bad job of that. But is there a larger point there? Like, you know, well, okay. I get your point, Ron. I thank you for the call. Neil in Lincolnwood, Illinois. Hey, Neil.
Hi.
Hi.
Is there... do members of Congress have immunity from prosecution for breaking any law?
Not for breaking laws. There are certain things that they can't be prosecuted for doing when they are on the property of Congress. And I don't recall the subtle distinction. Probably Shane knows that stuff better than me. But no, you don't either. Okay, but by and large, no. But the behavior that they're engaging in right now is not illegal. It's simply unethical, immoral, and anti-American.
But even in the case where the words blackmail or extortion have been thrown around, not to mention treason, certainly there seems to be a prima facie case for extortion.
No, this is all happening out in public. These are words that are hyperbolic. They're exaggerations. They're being used for effect. There is not real extortion going on. There's not real blackmailing going on, or at least not real by the definition of the law. Now, maybe we should change the law. But if you're going to change the law with regard to this stuff, that means you're going to have to get money out of politics. You're going to have to, you know, make basically what the Koch brothers do illegal, which means you're going to have to first get around the Supreme Court. You're going to either have to amend the Constitution, or Congress is going to have to step up to the plate and take its Article 3, Section 2 power and regulate the Supreme Court. Neil, thanks for the call. And by the way, to that point, Shane and I were talking about this earlier. McCutcheon, this very rich guy named McCutcheon, who wants to give much, much more money to politicians, has sued the Federal Election Commission, and this is being heard by the Supreme Court next Tuesday. And Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate Minority Leader, is going to argue before the United States Supreme Court that he thinks that as a politician, he should be able to be wholly owned by an individual billionaire. That billionaires should be able to come in and give unlimited amounts of money to politicians so that, you know, he doesn't have to spend all his time fundraising. He can just, you know, cut a deal with one business. You know, he can become the congressman, you know, Mitch McConnell, a senator from Big Coal, or Mitch McConnell, a senator from Big Nuke, or Mitch McConnell, a senator from the military industrial complex, or what, you know, he can just be owned by one group or one man. Mitch McConnell, the David Koch Sultan, wholly owned senator. I mean, obviously, he's not going to argue it in those terms, but that's the essence of his argument, which proves, in my opinion, that the Supreme Court, that we are no longer a democratic republic, that we are a constitutional monarchy, because now you have a member of the first branch of government, the legislative, going before the third branch of government, the judicial, which is supposed to be the least among equals, and saying, would you please change the law of the land that we back in Congress voted on and the president signed, first and second branches? Think about that one. Joan in Alexander, North Carolina. Hey, Joan.
Hi, Tom. Yes, on this woman that was shot in D.C., I was appalled when I heard what happened to her. And that's the first time today from you that I'd heard she'd been shot that many times in the face. I cannot believe that those cops could do something like that, could pull open her door, see who she was. If she had a gun, she would have shot him right then and there, it would seem like. And then they just blow her away with a little baby in the car over who knows what. I mean, I've been to D.C. twice for big rallies, and, yeah, traffic is very frustrating in D.C., but...
Well, this is more than that. I mean, there may have been an element of suicide by cop here. She might have been trying to get shot. Who knows? But...
Well, yeah, maybe.
But
I just think there were so many other things they could have done. You're right. They could have shot out her tires. They could have wounded her somehow. They could have done so many other things besides what they did.
It seems to me. Joan, thank you for your call. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. David in Addison, Illinois. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Actually, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what you and Senator Sanders were discussing as far as the post office goes.
Right.
Sorry to jump topics. But basically everything Senator Sanders is saying about the post office and the requirements set forth are a lie at worst or misrepresentation at best. So here's how it works. The post office, well, most government organizations pay health care benefits as the costs arise. And Senator Sanders said that the post office is the only organization that does this. That's a lie.
No, David, you're misinformed. In 2006, in the Postal Reform Bill, when it went into conference, slipped into it was a provision that over a 10-year period, the post office had to fully fund all of its retiree health benefits for a full 75 years. So that over a 10-year period, the post office has to pay about $5 billion a year to pay for the health retirement benefits of people who have not yet even been born. This is a provision that was, and this was at a time when the post office was profitable. They were talking about solarizing and electrifying their fleet. They were doing good stuff, and they were doing really, really well. This $5 billion a year payment that they have to make has crippled them, and it was put in intentionally to cripple them. There's over $30 billion now sitting in this fund that will be paid out 75 years from now. This is completely crazy. No federal agency does this. No private sector agency does this.
You're 100%.
I am not wrong, David. I am absolutely not wrong. And you can go look up the legislation. This is no secret. This is no secret at all. And this was a poison pill that was put in there by Republicans to cripple the post office. And the question that the caller was asking is, you know, now the Republicans are trying to privatize the post office. Is that poison pill, was that put in there to just suck as much money as possible into this giant savings account that's got, you know, $20-30 billion in it? So that when the post office gets privatized, whoever buys it can make off with that $20 or $30 billion. And that's actually starting to make some sense to me. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'd like to tell you why the Republicans hate Obamacare. And these are some seldom discussed reasons. First of all, job independence. They would be like worker independence. They wouldn't necessarily be tied to job health insurance anymore.
Right.
They could look around for a possible better job, and I think the Republicans hate that.
Yep. Plus, you can become an entrepreneur.
That's right. So that would actually make America stronger. And then secondly, the number one reason for personal bankruptcies is health expenses.
Yep, more than 50%.
Yeah, and people lose their homes over that. And if we move to Obamacare, there'll be a lot less stress. And stress is a harbinger of disease. And so up in Canada, when they go up there, they say, well, the people are so relaxed, they seem happier. Well, if we have this kind of coverage, then if we're less stressful, then America may become happier. And then a better chance to stop pandemics and epidemics, because people before, they wouldn't go in, you know, the uninsured, and that's a terrible way to start an epidemic. Whereas in Canada, you know, if you're feeling sick, people think, oh, I'm feeling sick, I'm going to go in to see what's wrong. And it's a better way to stop that problem. And then people take better care of themselves sooner. They're not worried that their policy is going to go up or they're going to lose their policy. So they don't wait till it's too late and then they go in. And I think a way to save tax dollar money is the most expensive form of health care is emergency room care. And if we're all covered, that'll reduce the taxpayer money going out for that. And perhaps it can be invested in a good dental plan, a national dental plan for everybody. So I say a healthy America is a strong America. And thank you for Obamacare.
Yeah, I'm with you, Harvey. And thank you for Obamacare as the first step to a healthier America. And that's another reason why the Republicans are fighting this so much, is because they know that Within probably a decade or so, Obamacare is going to lead to single-payer health care, at least in some states. Vermont has already passed it, and in 2016, when it becomes legal under Obamacare, they are going to put it into place. I'm absolutely, totally spot on with you. And the Republicans don't like this. It's not like they, you know, they hate Americans. It's that they want, I mean, keep in mind, the people who are funding the Tea Party Republicans are principally oil billionaires and banking billionaires and paper industry billionaires. Billionaires who make money in polluting industries, or in the case of banking, just downright dangerous industries. And they don't want to be regulated. They want more profits.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So if Obamacare works, Americans will start to say, hey, you know, maybe government does work. Maybe we should elect people who trust government, like Elizabeth Warren, and they will regulate the banks and the oil companies. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Bob Ney, with the former Congressman Bob Ney, now a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News brought to you, by the way, by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, on the line with us. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. I hope you are, too.
Sure, yeah.
I have a question. I understand that this woman who was killed here yesterday after she ran her car into the barriers at both the White House and the Congress, the U.S. Capitol, that she was shot so badly that she could not be identified by her face. In other words, she had apparently either one very large round or several rounds in her that smashed up her face pretty badly. Did that happen while she was in her car? I read one news report that said that it happened as she was getting out or after she got out of her car. And why did they feel the need to kill this woman like this rather than shooting her tires out?
Two good questions. The tire thing, it baffles me. Now, I understand the Capitol Hill police, they don't know if she's got dynamite, the car's got dynamite. I fully understand that. You know, I dealt with the police for years out there. But the one thing, I don't know if it's confusion or whatever, but the shooting of the tires would be the best thing that could be have done. And she went around the circle. As far as I know, there were reports she was shot outside the car. As far as I know, the shots were all a lot of shots into the car as it was moving towards the final barrier it hit.
Uh-huh.
That's as much as I know of that one. I don't think, I could be horribly wrong, but I don't think she was walking outside the car with her hands up and got shot.
Okay, isn't that, rather than shooting the tires out, shooting the driver? I mean, if she dies, falls forward, or foot's on the accelerator, that could turn that car into a far more deadly weapon than it already was, could it not?
Well, you know, I don't know. It could. The one thing about it, when they get that close to the Capitol, you know, the barriers worked. But the point, you know, is what was in the car. They had to stop the car. But
sure, because they didn't know if it was a Tim McVeigh car.
Yeah, but the shooting of the tires, I thought that myself today, Tom. I thought, wow, you know, naturally, just shoot the tires first.
Right.
I don't know if it was.
Well, that's. I thought that's what they used to do. I mean, you know, maybe it's a new brave new world or something.
I think they thought maybe she had something and they've got to stop them.
Yeah. Well, they had no idea what she had. I mean, you know, she might have had a small nuke for all they knew.
You never know.
Yeah. So anyhow, what's going on in the world, Bob?
Well, very interesting in our world in Washington D.C. You know, this is all really about one person, John Boehner. Period. It seriously is. The Republicans in the Senate are having a fit. Mitch McConnell et al., of course, he has a primary as a Tea Party guy, but they believe this will cost them the Senate. They will not take back control of the Senate. So it's a lot about control in politics versus public policy. But here, John Boehner is sitting there, and he doesn't want the default to happen. He can't have two things. So he might divide the baby. He can't have the debt ceiling cause a default while the government shut down. They could put together a massive bill where they would still have Obamacare in there to take it out, and then the Democrats take it out. But his conference is telling him, at least the vocal ones, the 53 or 54, hold firm. The other problem he has, John Boehner cannot get a clean CR passed, temporary resolution passed. I'll bet you he can't get one passed. Because that in itself, on the Democratic side, it has cuts. A lot of his own conference doesn't want a temporary measure. So he's sitting there, and as far as is Boehner, I think what he may do is to put in there some of the things they've been wanting, you know, in smaller things, Social Security, maybe a commission on entitlements, and where does it go from there, and try to get a deal with President Obama on that. I think he's in a box. He's in a complete box. And now it's a
box of his own creation, by the way. He's had clean continuing resolution on his desk from day one. He never had to shut down the government. He could have simply put it to the floor, and he would have had, you know, we know now at least 19 or 20 Republicans, probably over 100, who would have voted for it, and it would have passed.
He has a circular firing squad.
Yeah.
What he's in.
Yeah, he's created his own circular firing squad. He's standing in the middle of it and about to yell, shoot.
And he, look, at the end of the day, if he's going to try to capture Democratic votes, which he has to for the debt ceiling increase, and Republicans, then just throw the whole thing out there anyway. And this whole Hastert rule is a misnomer anyway. Even former Speaker Hastert said, well, that's not really what I meant, that every bill had to be passed. He just said that yesterday, by Republican votes majority only. So if he was going to throw it out there, this is about his speakership. This is about trying to satisfy an element in his caucus and try to contain the rest of the caucus. I think he's went so many directions it has doomed him. This is his political obituary for re-election for speakership, not because of he's so, you know, leadership star quality, but because he created something now that he can't get out of.
So what does he do?
I think he puts a package together. He tries to sell it to his Congress. Look, we're going to get a few things we could never get. We're going to get some budget numbers we want, but Obamacare is not going to become.
Right. So do you so then the bigger question in my mind is what does the president, because Boehner's going to be asking for concessions. What does the president do? I mean, is he going to give him a chain CPI, for example? Is he going to cut Social Security? I mean, the Republicans are looking for blood here. And the president up to this point has been saying, give me a clean CR and raise the debt ceiling. No negotiations. We got, you know, we don't negotiate with terrorists. You're getting nothing.
Well, at the end of the day, they may actually, believe it or not, I'm safe in saying trust the president on some of his commitments down the line than they trust each other in the House and Senate. And that might be an accurate statement. The president might yield to a few things. He's not going to yield to undoing Obamacare, and he's not going to yield to decimating Social Security.
I know that the medical devices tax seems like it's on the table in a big way. There are even Democrats who don't like that because the medical device lobby is passing out a lot of money in Congress right now.
That's right.
So is that a face-saving way? They do away with the medical devices tax, and they can say, oh, look, we cut $30 billion out of Obamacare. You know, we shaved it. We didn't slash its throat, but we nicked it. And
they can do that, and then they'll say, we live to fight another day.
Yeah, I think you're right. Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, author of the brilliant book, Sideswiped. If you haven't read it, you want to know how Washington, D.C. works, read Sideswiped by Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And John Boehner could end all of this today. Put these folks back to work. It's really quite remarkable. You want to see something really funny? Take a look at the Huffington Post and then look at the Drudge Report. It's like they're describing two different countries. It is astounding how siloed we've become in one way, first of all. How people just, you know, okay, this is my political world, I'm going to live in it, and I don't want to know about any other. I find that astounding. And I also find astounding how terrified the Republican, how John Boehner, how he's clearly terrified, not just of 30 House Republicans. People say he's afraid of the Tea Party caucus. He's afraid of the 30 or so Republicans who were elected to Congress with billionaire money. It's not just that. He's afraid on behalf of the other 405 members of the House of Representatives, the other, 200 more or less, 180 and 190 members, Republican members of the House of Representatives, who are afraid that they're going to get primaried over the next 6 months in their home district by a Tea Partier. And many of them will be, trust me. And he's afraid he's going to face a primary. And he's afraid that he might not be Speaker of the House for another year. And there's a lot of perks that come with being Speaker of the House for just, a nice alcoholic kid who grew up in a bar in Ohio. Right? A lot of perks. That's not to knock alcoholics, but being a high-functioning alcoholic is not, I think, a good thing when the person is the arguably second or third most powerful person in the United States. So anyhow, my thoughts on that. Mary in Oak Park, Illinois. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Well, I was calling because I was so grateful to finally hear one person talk about the unnecessary killing of that woman yesterday. When I watched the footage early evening last night, when she was in front of the, wherever that intersection was to the White House, she wasn't in front of the White House, the policemen already had their guns drawn. One was literally inside her car talking to her. They were prepared, could have shot, she did not need to do the chase. They were prepared to shoot those cars. Why they did not intervene? So they knew there was a child in that car. They knew the woman was erratic. It just seems to me that it's just another black life that's not worth very much money. I'm a white woman from a suburb of Chicago, and I'm appalled because in my heart it feels like they murdered that.
Was this woman African-American? I saw a picture of her that I thought she looked kind of Asian. But she was African-American?
No, she's African-American, yeah.
Oh, my.
And it just, it's heartbreaking because if you watch that very early footage, they were in stance, their guns were drawn. Why didn't they shoot out those tires? I didn't understand as I was watching it yesterday. And it's heartbreaking, and no one's talking about it. The Chicago Tribune, do you know where that article is? Page 14.
Yeah.
Because it's a worthless life. It's very disheartening.
It's very sad. Mary, thank you for the call. Thank you for sharing your heartfelt thoughts. Jason in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Tom. In a few weeks, we'll be discussing the debt limits. And my question for you is there a certain amount where you say the government can't take in on any more debt? Because what we're actually going to do is with the high loads of debt, if the interest rates start to go up to back to where they were just 5 or 6 years ago, you're going to have the vast majority of the budget going to pay interest, which will endanger Social Security and Medicare.
I don't disagree, Jason. I think that when you look at what has caused the budget deficit, you see that about half of it was caused by the Bush tax cuts. About a little more than a third of it was caused by the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so, and I'm talking about even the ongoing deficits. And then the rest of it was caused by the recession, by the Republicans deregulating the banksters. And I'm all in favor of stopping. We did stop the war in Iraq. Let's wind down the war in Afghanistan. We still are going to have about $5 trillion in expenses as a consequence of George Bush having started those two wars that we're going to have to pay off. The Bush tax cuts took at least $1 trillion, maybe two, out of the economy during that decade that they were in place and added that to the deficit. And then on top of that, there's all the opportunity cost and opportunity lost, the investments in infrastructure. We could have been putting kids to college. We could have been building, we could have been doing like China's doing, building high-speed rail, building, doing like South Korea. Everybody has, high-speed broadband that's very, very cheap. There's so many things that we could have been doing instead of giving tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires and fighting two wars in places where we had no business doing wars. And so, I think that our debt is too high, and I think that the thing to do about it is very simple and very straightforward. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts, number one. Start getting revenue back in line. Corporations, back before Reagan came into office, corporations were paying about a third of the total tax burden in the United States. Now they're paying about 10%. That's nuts. So change the tax code, Close the corporate loopholes. You got the richest corporations in America paying nothing in taxes. ExxonMobil, most profitable corporation in the history of the planet, paying nothing in federal income taxes. Change the tax code. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts, basically, both on corporations and on wealthy individuals, number one. Then you get more revenue coming in. Number two, change our trade policies. Go back to pre-Reagan trade policies where we actually had protectionist trade policies like most other countries in the world do. And the jobs will come back home. When the jobs come back home, the labor market will tighten up. Wages will start going back up again. They've been flat since Ronald Reagan was elected president. Let's kick those wages back up. As those wages go up, you're going to see tax collections going to go up, and you are going to see that debt start coming down. In fact, you're going to see not just the deficits go down, you're going to see surplus budgets, and you're going to see the debt go down. And this is just, these are just two very simple things that could be done. And frankly, I think the majority of Americans, you look at the era of the great prosperity, that great prosperity time from the 1940s to the 1980s, top marginal tax rate was 91% to 74%, and our trade at average import tariffs was around 30%. So let's just do common sense stuff. You say, you know, what country should we imitate? We should imitate us. We should undo the Reagan Revolution. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say a few days ago I, you know, found out about the government shutdown, so I decided to call my congressman, but also I called Ted Cruz's office, and it was really kind of an interesting conversation, but the gist was that, you know, the Tea Partiers apparently feel that their voice hasn't been heard. And I said, well, how so? You've gotten what you wanted, and you're making the rest of us suffer quite a bit, and you've shut down the government. You know, so I don't quite understand. They seem to have no ability to compromise whatever. And it was really interesting. I was in San Francisco, and the Chronicle had a picture of a lot of disgusted tourists who were not going to be able to go to, I think it was Alcatraz. Also, the Golden Gate Bridge Center was closed because it's a national monument, Rays Point National Monument. But also, you know, the most interesting thing about this shutdown, or one of the things, is the fact that poor people are affected unduly, and also the Centers for Disease Control are not able to track diseases. There's right. Many different diseases that people have not, you know, that are kind of under the radar because they haven't reached, you know, a high
crisis proportion. Yeah.
And
TB being one of them. And yeah, it's we don't have our jobs numbers from the Department of Labor. This is just nuts. This is just nuts. In fact, thank you, John, for the call. I want to rant up. I'll tell you about my Uber driver in about 5 minutes. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Had the most interesting conversation this morning with basically the taxi driver who drove me in this morning. I'll tell you about it. So. Okay, my taxi ride story. Here in D.C., we Uber started out as the service for limousine drivers who had, you know, spare time. And it was a little bit more expensive than a cab. I don't own a car, and usually Louise and I take public transportation, but occasionally things get a little nuts, and you got to grab a car. And, in fact, every single day I walk out of here and I walk down to Union Station. I take the subway over to the TV studios. But this morning, Uber has this new thing called UberX that's actually 18% less expensive than cabs, and they ding it to my credit card. You know, it's an app. It's really I just love Uber. It really works well. And I don't like the cabs in this town. They're the worst cabs I've ever experienced in my whole entire life anywhere. There's some very nice people who are driving some of the cabs, but just in general, the way the system works, it's broken. So this Uber driver picks me up at my house or at the, you know, out in front of the marina, and he's driving me over here to the radio studio. And he doesn't know my politics, you know, I don't know his. And he says, so what's going on with the government shutdown? And I said, well, what do you think? And he said, well, I can tell you I'm losing money, He said that, you know, there's not much going on in this town, and, you know, normally I would be chock-a-block. I would be solidly always, you know, my car would always be full, and right now it's not. And he says, and I got a friend who runs a restaurant, and he was of some sort of Asian ethnicity. So I got the impression from the way he was talking that his friend owned an ethnic restaurant, you know, like a Chinese restaurant, something like that. He says, I got a friend who runs a small restaurant, and, you know, that's a pretty tight margin, that business. And if he goes even just a couple of weeks, really bad weeks during the time of year when he's expecting to have good weeks, it could really hurt him. I mean, it could really hurt him, and it is hurting him right now. He said there are business people, he said, all over the city who, particularly the people who depend on tourism, which is a major industry here in Washington, D.C., people, the tourists are not coming because everything's closed. Right, the monuments are closed. The Smithsonian, all the museums, they're all free all the time, open. People come from all over the world. They're not coming. And he's like, this is really hurting us. Now, this has nothing to do with the 800,000 to a million federal workers who've been laid off. This is the knock-on effect. Those federal workers who have been laid off are not eating in this guy's friend's restaurant. They're not having lunch there. Louise and I, last night, we went out to dinner. I think I mentioned in one of the fundraising things that we went out to dinner with some people who had donated money to Free Speech TV. And if at a certain donation level, you know, you get to come to D.C. and have dinner with me and Louise. And we didn't even make a reservation. We just walked around the corner from the TV studio after the show was over and walked into this very nice Italian restaurant over on F Street, which we've really come to like. And just walk in. There were maybe four tables filled. I mean, these guys are freaking out. They're hurting. And it's like the Republicans, they don't care. As long as the bars are open, John Boehner's happy. This is so sad. Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Thanks a lot for your show, and thanks for your enthusiastic support for Free Speech TV. I've been a contributor for quite a while, and I probably should try to contribute more. I just wanted to point out to anybody out there who is hesitant to make a monthly contribution, just think of it this way. When you go through a fast food drive-through or buy a cup of overpriced coffee or all the other trivial things that you spend your money on, and just think, you know, that money's gone in an instant. But with Free Speech TV, with your show, Democracy Now!, and all the fantastic documentaries, you know, that's it's just priceless knowledge. It stays with you. And, you know, it'd be, you know, if you just spend a fraction of that by a month on Free Speech TV, I think it's a bargain by any stretch of the imagination. I think it would be a shame to lose this network and have to count on corporate media to inform you, you know, for
sure
things. And, just, you know, when you're watching the nightly news and all of a sudden a commercial comes on for BP, how they're saving the Gulf or the Bank of America, how they're doing so much with your money. And
I got it, Dave. I got it. And you said it very eloquently. Thank you very much. Let me, and for those of you who don't know what Dave is talking about, who might be listening in some other way, Free Speech TV is having their fund drive. In fact, today's the last day, and we're carried simulcast as television on Free Speech TV. But also, we are carried on nonprofit radio stations, on Pacifica stations. Many of them are in their fund drives right now. WBAI is picking us up. They're doing a fund drive. KPFK in Los Angeles is, I think their fund drive is over. I'm not sure that they're in one right now. KBCS, I think, in Seattle is having a fund drive right now. But also, many of you are listening on commercial stations. And if you're listening on a commercial station in Madison or Minnesota, you know, or in Chicago or something like New York City, you can support your commercial stations too. If you support progressive programming, you know, it's like three different ways to do it. Obviously, if you're non-commercial, you donate to the station, and they'll be coming on during the time that the commercial stations are selling commercials. They're asking for donations. But when you would be amazed. For the commercial stations that we're on, you would be amazed how much power it has. If you call, say, there's a local company that does roofing or a company that does landscaping or something like that. There's, you know, a local business that's advertising on your local radio station or underwriting one of the nonprofit stations that we're on. Some of them take underwriting, some of them don't. And you hear that, you know, whatever it may be, lawn services is subsidized. Even if you don't need their service, you call them up and tell them, hey, I heard your underwriting statement or I heard your ad on this station, and I want you to know that I will pass that along to friends who might need your services. And it does so much good. I guess it's just this is the time of year. You know, this is the time of year when everybody's in their fund drives. And thus, you know, Dave's call. But if you're listening to us on commercial radio, in just a minute, you're going to hear a commercial break. And if you could call one of those advertisers or call the station and let them know that you're listening, that goes a long way. If you're listening on non-commercial radio and they're in a fund drive, be sure to pitch in. If you're watching Free Speech TV, here's your opportunity. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And let me just thank you, by the way, however you're getting this show. Thank you so much for listening and for supporting our program. Fair and always slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kathy in Valparaiso, Indiana. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hi, Mr. Hartman. I agree with Mary, the caller out of Chicago, and what she had to say. She was like the sixth caller back. Mm-hmm. But I want to refresh your memory about a little of what happened in South Carolina with that gentleman that had the car accident, and he went to get help, and then he was running toward the police because the people called, when he was beating on their houses, they called the police, and then they shot him.
Mm.
And killed him, you know, as he was running toward them, and then they found out he had a car accident. Well, what I'm getting at is what happened in Washington with that lady. The first thing went through my mind was she's scared, she's diabetic, she could be lost. But why didn't they throw down the stop sticks to blow out her tires? They didn't even have to shoot out the tires with a gun.
Right.
In Indiana, they when you have a vehicle or, you know, a car chase with the police, they throw those sticks down.
Well, you have to, in order to throw those sticks down, you have to know where the car is going and
but
get out
going
ahead.
Around
of
and around in circles, wasn't she? That's what I saw on TV.
Yeah, well.
You'd think if they're going to put barriers and carry guns and bullet clubs that somebody would have had a stop stick somewhere.
Yeah.
But what I'm, my point is this is happening more and more frequently. And I raised my kids, even though I was a teacher, to question authority. And you tell your children if you need help, you go to the police. Well, what we're getting on TV and all this is the opposite. The police is, like, intimidating everybody and scaring everybody.
Yeah.
So who would want, as a child, go to them for help?
Yeah. And I wonder what has caused this, because this is not how the police behaved when I was a child. This is not the way that the behavior of police was portrayed on television in the 60s and 70s. And I really think this began with the Dirty Harry movies. And now, I mean, the other day, Louise and I went to see a movie. I don't remember the title of it, but the guy was basically a bad cop. Well, even, actually, we were watching a CSI Miami the other day, and you know, where the cop just basically, you know, smashes a guy, and then, you know, everybody kind of pretends he didn't do it. It's like, really? Really? Is that what we've come to? Kathy, thanks for the call. Andrew in Ashland, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. I am going to agree with you 100% about that shooting incident in D.C. I only wanted to add that all the cable news coverage that we had for hours and hours, they brought all kind of experts and analysts, and none of them ever asked that question that you did ask earlier.
Why did they have to shoot this woman in the head?
And these are supposed to be expert, and they're supposed to know, you know, exactly what's going on. So I agree with you 100%. I do not know if they are investigating this any further, but, I mean, there's so much going on that we need to know why this is happening.
Well, I think every time an officer discharges a weapon, there's an investigation. Whether those investigations are thorough, though, I mean, the FBI, for example, has killed, according to what I learned watching Rachel Maddow's show, in the last 50 years has killed about 150 people, and 100% of the time, according to their own internal investigations, it's not been their fault, and everything's been copacetic. You know, that's a little fishy, but we'll see. You know, time will tell. But thank you, Andrew. I could be off base on this. I mean, it might be that the police did exactly what they should have done. It just didn't look that way to me watching the video. Bobby in Denver. Hey, Bobby, what's up? Thanks for listening to AM 760.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, I'm a truck driver, and I go all over the country. We have terminals in different states. And the day after that tragic shooting at the Naval Station, I was at one of our yards in Idaho, a very red state. And I walked into the driver's lounge, and no one was there, so I flipped to the TV. And, hey, there's Tom Hartman on TV. Cool. So I sit down to watch, and within a few minutes, four other drivers walked in. And, you know, at the beginning of that, when you were talking about gun control, and like, oh, is he for guns? He wants to take our guns. Who wants to take our guns? I mean, these guys were Republicans, gun-toting, and very hardcore. And the fascinating part was...
So hang on just a second here, Bobby. So you put me on the TV in the truck stop?
Yeah, well, at our trucker's lounge.
So, yes. Okay, so you flipped it from Fox to Tom to Free Speech TV.
Yeah,
well, what a hoot. Okay.
And
so go ahead.
The fascinating part was they were all, you know, anytime the word gun came out of your mouth, no. But the fascinating part was we sat there and watched the entire show, and they agreed with everything else you had to say about the raising the minimum wage and income inequality. And you had that guy that caught on that was saying that, unskilled workers shouldn't make a lot of money. They can get roommates, and you got to put them in his place, and they're cheering you on. And I just thought it was fascinating, you know, that here these Republicans never heard of you, didn't know who you were, but they agreed with everything else you had to say that day, Tom.
I am convinced, Bobby. I used to be a regular guest on Fox. I pretty much quit doing that, and now they've pretty much quit inviting me, and I think it's because I've been trashing them so much. But it doesn't matter. The thing that I have noticed is that they are so finely calibrated. They're so careful in making sure that people stay within that conservative bubble. I genuinely believe that average Americans, like you said, these truckers, that average working Americans are basically on probably pretty much every issue that I talk about on this program are with me, are with us, are with the Bernie Sanders progressive position. It's why, you know, when Louise and I lived in Vermont, during the 2004 elections, we were living, well, actually, I think in the 2004, we might have been living in Oregon. But anyhow, I remember driving through the Northwest Kingdom, Northeast Kingdom, this very rural, very conservative area of Vermont that votes like 80% for George Bush. And people would have Bush signs in their front yard and Bernie Sanders signs in their front yard because he tells the truth on economic issues. And I think that if Americans were exposed to the actual discussions, to this worldview that you and I are talking about here, Bobby, that the majority of them would agree. But that's great that you flipped us on the truck stop there. Thank you for that.
Uh-huh. Hey, Tom, a couple of weeks ago, you were talking about the Iran-Iraq war a few times and about how Reagan had sold the missiles. You know, we stabbed Iran in the back. I was stationed at King Fahd Air Base in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, back in 1986 and 87. And I flew with the E-3As, the radar planes. You know, we monitored all the airtime traffic and maritime traffic in the Persian Gulf. And we had Arabic-speaking personnel as well as Persian-speaking personnel on board because, you know, they speak Persia in Iran.
Right, Farsi.
And we were in contact with the Iraqi fighter pilots and the Iranian fighter pilots to make sure that they weren't shooting at any of our planes or ships or any of our allies' planes or ships. Now, check this out. We were not only in contact with the Iraqi fighter pilot saying, yes, that's an Iranian plane you shoot at. Yes, that's an Iranian ship. We were also in contact with the Iranian fighter pilot saying, yes, that's an Iraqi ship. Yes, that's an Iraqi plane you can fire at it. Talk about stabbing Iraq in the back. I just wanted to add that to what you were saying about how we were stabbing Iraq in the back.
Wow, amazing. Bobby, thank you. Thank you for both. That's a fascinating call. I appreciate it. Dominic in Severn, Maryland. Hey, Dominic.
Yeah, about the lady in D.C.
Yeah.
I think the cops were actually quite restrained initially. If you look at the video, from what they knew there was a chase, some kind of a chase scene. They managed to stop her, and they actively did something because they drove a car up behind her. And then they were trying to get her to come out of the car.
Right.
At that point, I think something happened with their training. Cops are normally trained to tell somebody to put their car in park before getting out.
Right.
And because the person's rattled, they often forget to do that, and then either the car goes forward or goes, or they, when they get out, or they forget and they mess up and put it in reverse, and it backs up into the police car behind them. And so I think that may have been what they thought was happening at first. But then when she put it back in drive and hit the gas, you know, they had to scramble to get out of her way.
Right, I saw that.
And
at that point, why didn't they shoot out the tires?
Well, you really can't. You notice she was traveling away from them by the time they started firing.
So you just can't get low enough to shoot out the tires, and also anytime you're doing something like that, you're risking collateral, you're risking shooting bystanders. Is that the kind of thing?
Yeah, and also a tire is not an easy target to hit in that situation, and it may not even be effective. Police use soft bullets, hollow tip, so they may just flatten out and they hit the tire, not actually penetrate it.
Oh, that's interesting.
And, you know, anytime the police are trained that anytime you're going to fire, it has to be a situation where killing is justified, and then if they do fire, shoot to kill.
Right.
And so she had demonstrated that she had no regard for anybody's safety. And,
so it was a disregard for human life, therefore she could be killed. But again, why not incapacitate her instead of killing her?
Well, you don't know what she is capable of.
Right.
If you're going to use a gun, the training is to shoot her, to shoot to kill.
Why, though? It hasn't always been that way.
No, it has been that way. I know people that were trained, that took police training back in the 70s.
And at that time, if you pull your service revolver, if you're prepared to shoot, you should first shoot to kill rather than shoot to incapacitate.
Yes. If you're going to use lethal force, then use lethal force.
What about, I thought the doctrine was that you use the minimum amount of force necessary, and that could mean shooting somebody's legs out rather than shooting their head off.
Well, even if you shoot somebody in the leg, it might kill them.
I understand that, but it's less likely to kill him if you shoot him in the head.
That's true, but the threshold is that killing is justified.
Yeah.
And if it's justified, then it's justified.
Okay. I understand the logic of it, Dominic. I absolutely understand the logic of it. And I, like I said, I may be totally wrong on this. It's really, really easy to Monday morning quarterback this stuff, and I was not a police officer on the ground, and I know it's a hell of a tough job, but... I'm scratching my head. Dominic, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So was it a justified killing or not? I guess we're going to have to wait for the investigation to find out. It's still shaking. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producers, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at the various companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One on the commercial side, Pacifica Radio on the non-commercial side, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, CRN Network on cable systems all over the country, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show from Comcast to Manhattan Neighborhood Network, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room. Hey, how you doing there? To Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, to our sponsors and underwriters, and to you for supporting our affiliates, the stations on which we, however you're hearing or seeing this program, and whatever organizations may be associated with them, thank you so much for shouting out to them, for contacting them, and letting them know that this program has value and that you support what they're doing. Without you, we would not be here. Thank you. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. One additional thing that maybe people could do, consider doing too, would be, in addition to donating to Free Speech currently, but maybe consider putting them in their will, or the Hunter School in the will.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Yeah.
Yeah, just a thought here. But this is something I came upon here today. Very interesting in regard to what's going on in our country right now. This would drive Boehner completely and his Republican people nuts.
Mm-hmm.
The Swiss, they're going to take a vote here. To what they want to do is they want to give their people, all adults, income. They want to cut them a check for $2,800 a month income for each adult in a move to combat growing pay inequality.
A national minimum income, regardless of whether you're working or not, regardless of what you work at. $2,800 a month, really?
Yep.
Wow, that's substantial.
MSN world right now.
So then what? Employers dial back on what they pay people? Is that what comes along with that?
I don't really know what's really going on there, but they're also talking about there's another proposal on limiting CEO pay. It's called the so-called 1 to 12 initiative,
and that right.
Faced the popular vote on November 24th.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to look into this, Steve. I mean, the big question, of course, is this something that just happened to get on the ballot because a small fringe group was able to get it on? The groups that sometimes will get on a ballot, something like let's create a UFO landing pad, or is this actually coming out of one of the major political parties or a serious effort?
It's an interesting proposal, and it's the antithesis to what the Republicans offer.
Well, and if you go back and you read Agrarian Justice, which Thomas Paine wrote in the 1790s, it's what he suggested. And, it's one of the few parts of the New Deal that didn't get implemented. That he basically, he laid out the New Deal in Agrarian Justice. So very interesting. Thanks a lot, Steve, for sharing that with us. Jack in Denver. Hey, Jack, thanks for listening to 760 AM. What's up?
Hey, Tom, long-time listener.
Thank you.
I think I've talked to you a couple of times. Just the Dominic had called there, and just a clarification on that.
With regard to police and the use of force?
Yeah. That they don't, the protocol is pretty much universal. He was on the right track. If the situation has to require deadly force, and you were also correct in that it's also he used the minimum amount of force necessary to effect the arrest or to stop the unlawful activity.
Are you a police officer?
However, I am.
Okay, so you know this stuff. Continue.
I am. Yeah, 3 decades. So if the situation does justify using deadly physical force, then the protocol is to shoot to stop the unlawful activity and not necessarily to kill. Of course, oftentimes it results in that.
Right.
But that's a critical point. Not the police don't shoot to kill necessarily. There are times, headshots and sniper, hostage situations. That's different.
Right. So, as a police officer, have you seen the videotape of this?
I have not. I've only read the news article. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. All right. I would have been very curious to hear your thoughts on it. Because, I'm very reluctant. I went through the Georgia Police Academy back in the, back when the Olympics came to Atlanta and they opened it to civilians for the very first time ever. And I was working on a book on private detectives, and an old friend, DeWitt Wanamaker, who was a long-time southern rural Georgia sheriff, small-town sheriff, and was working as a PI. He got me in, and I actually went through the Georgia Police Academy and earned a lot of respect. I have a lot of respect for people who are in law enforcement. And
it's an aisle.
Yeah. I mean, when you see it from the inside, you realize there's really good people doing some really, really hard work and having to make life-and-death decisions in a split second. And in that whole context, it's really difficult to criticize somebody who's got a 3,000-pound car coming at him at 70 miles an hour doing anything, to criticize whatever their behavior is. That said, go ahead.
That was a very key point, Tom, too, because there's constitutional case law that specifies precisely that. You can't judge, they can't even, a citizen's mindset, you can't. Has to be judged, a police officer's action legally has to be judged in terms of use of force by what a reasonable officer would do based on the information that the officer had at that time and not 20/20 hindsight.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the caveat that I want to attach to my critique. And yet, when I watched that video, when they had that woman's car stopped and there was a police officer standing with his gun, his service revolver drawn, and he was right behind her right left tire. And I'm wondering, why is he not shooting out that tire right now? And then she goes tearing off. But maybe, I'm not a police officer, so I don't know. Jack, thank you for calling, and thanks for the clarification. I do appreciate it. Thanks for listening. AM 760 there in Denver. We will be back on Monday. We'll have a whole weekend's worth of entertainment to talk about. But most of all, the latest on the shutdown and whatnot. But most of all, don't forget, if we're going to make this country work, we can't just sit around and you know, say, oh, look at those crazy Republicans. Let's have a laugh. No, seriously, we've got to get involved. Get out there, get active, and join an organization. Show up. Tag your.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.